On the large war map in the Emperor's palace in Damascus, the province of Palestine was colored in green and simply labeled Judea. This single color and this single label gave to this piece of Syrian geography a sense of cohesiveness and of unity, which it did not, in fact, possess. There is a rough parallel between ancient Judea and modern South Vietnam. Both nations were dominated by a capital in which a few rich and powerful families and men dominated political life. These few, a junta, controlled all the important offices and perquisites. The prerogative was theirs. What they lacked was the loyalty and the affection and the respect of their fellow citizens. In the second century before the Common Era, Judea was ready for revolt. There were many grievances. There were onerous, crushing taxes, little of which went to public works, to the public welfare, much of which went into the pockets of the ruling class to be transferred into bank accounts carefully secreted in the financial capitals of the day. The sons of the countryside were impressed into the armies of Emperor Antiochus to die for his political ambitions in the depths of the Caucasus and farthermost India. The sons of the rich escaped conscription. When an elder went to visit Jerusalem to bring sacrifice to his God in the Holy Temple, he was sure to be scandalized by the irreverent priest class, who cared not one whit for their sacerdotal function, and openly and callously outbid one another for title, for tithe. And this same elder was sure to be scandalized by the vulgarity and the irreverence and the alien quality of life in the capital. The young bucks of the holy city preferred Greek sophistry to the Torah. They would not speak the sacred language. They had it in contempt. They called it barbaric. Only the Greek tongue came mellifluously to their lips. Many of them practiced the Greek athletics naked in the public places according to the Hellenic manner. And they mocked and jeered the elders who spoke to them reprovingly of tzniut. Tzniut, the ancient virtue of modesty in dress and in manner. Above all, the well-to-do and the powerful and their children wanted to be Greek, like unto the proconsul and his officers. To be Hellenic in spirit was to be welcomed into the larger world of Greek culture. To be Hellenic in spirit was to have put your foot on the first step of the ladder of political preferment in the empire. The fire was laid. The time of revolution was at hand. It required only that a match be set to the kindling, and the spark was provided almost negligently by the Emperor Antiochus himself. He had not meant deliberately to incite the Hebrews. All that he had required was a loyalty oath of all of his subjects, the simple act of performing a sacrifice to his patron god, Zeus Olympius. This was a traditional form of loyalty required by many an ancient emperor. Senators, emperors, have always wondered at the silent, seemingly passive few who refuse to bow the head and bow their judgment and pledge unconditional loyalty. But then, common folk and college professors are not as used to as are the presidents and kings and emperors and senators to the solemn making of treaties, the solemn pledging of the national word and to its equally solemn breaking. Now, the State Department had told Emperor Antiochus that the Hebrews did have some strange religious scruples. There was a law in their scripture which forbade them to worship any idols, strange indeed in a nation which worshipped many idols. And Antiochus, to satisfy these minor underlings of his State Department, had sent a special assistant from his office to Judea. And he had conferred with the high officials of the land, and he had been assured by these important Judeans, whose names he knew, that the matter could be managed without untoward result. Indeed, they promised the emperor through his envoy that they would be the first to bring sacrifice and to pledge loyalty. How could one know, so many miles away in Damascus, with so many other things of state in front of one's mind, that in a faraway provincial city, an old priest would break the peaceful habits of a lifetime and take a sword to the Greek officer and to the local Quisling chief who came to perform the rites of loyalty. The office of the Central Intelligence Bureau in Jerusalem was taken by surprise. Rebellion? There was no rebellion in Judah. This was simply the act of a mad priest. Such men as set fire to their clothes. Rebellion? What had the Jews to rebel against? An intelligent officer had only to walk outside his billet to see that the Judeans welcomed all things Greek, indeed were eager for them. Rebellion. The Central Intelligence Agency was not told of the men from all the villages, the young men, the sturdy men, the strong men, who simply slipped away from farm and home and disappeared into the hills to join the old priest Mattathias and his sons in open rebellion, demanding freedom of religion, demanding freedom from the restraint upon their religion. Then a report came into the office in Jerusalem, the Bureau of Intelligence, which told that the old priest had died in his hideout. This was a shame. It would have been far better if he could have been brought to trial and his death made a public example. But the case was closed, so be it. And then strange reports began to come in from throughout the land. Strange reports indeed. The government's arsenals were looted. Supply trains were ambushed. Villages were terrorized. That was the official word, terrorized, which meant that the local Quisling Judean chief who had been sent down by the Jerusalem junta had been surprised and murdered by the men of the Maccabees. Well, it was time for a show of force. And special advisors, counterinsurgency specialists, were sent to the various villages. And these too, in time, were surprised, and some of them were murdered. And now troops were openly ordered from Damascus into the field, 1,000 men of the best of the rangers, the best of the mercenaries of the emperor. These men were under orders. Search, seize, kill, erase these rebels who condemn the emperor. Their lieutenant assured them that they would be back in Damascus for the holidays. But they had not yet heard of a certain Judah. A certain Judah the Hammerhead, Judah the Maccabee, third son of the old priest. A man of intrepid bravery, a man of clever skill, self-taught in the art and the strategy of guerrilla warfare, who had somehow by the force of his person imposed his will upon the many from this village and from that who came to demand religious freedom for their people, and who had organized the Judean bands into a carefully regimented guerrilla army. Nor had they counted on the cooperation which Judah received from the countryside. Every movement of the Syrian troops was reported immediately to Judah. The column of 1,000 trained rangers left Jerusalem, and false information was brought to them which led them deeper and deeper into the Judean hills. And then one day, when they were spread out along a sinuous mountain defile, they were ambushed and attacked, and only a few escaped. Judah was now known. But when another troop was sent out to find Judah and his men in these selfsame hills, they had disappeared into the soil. Where were they? They had simply hidden their daggers and their swords and returned to their farms and picked up their plows, and you couldn't tell them from the civilians. All that Judah and his men demanded at this time was that the great idol, the despicable idol of Zeus Olympius, be taken down from the sanctuary in Jerusalem, that the sanctuary be purged, be cleansed, be purified for the worship of the one God, beside whom there was no idol and no other God. But a great empire does not negotiate with a few rebels. The escalation was determined upon, and a great army for those days, 40,000 men and 7,000 cavalrymen, were summoned to Damascus, placed under the leadership of one of the finest and most skillful men of the day, Lysias the general, and ordered to root out this rebellion, root and branch, to erase it from the face of the earth. And Lysias promised his troops that it would not be a difficult task. They outnumbered the rebels 10-1. The kill ratio would be in their favor. Fanfare and trumpets Lysias sent out. And Judah, of course, lacked the men and lacked the equipment to meet him in open battle. But again, the support of the people, anxious for Judah's rebellion to win through, came to his aid. And he was told of every reconnaissance patrol sent out by the main body, and these were attacked, ambushed, killed. Finally, he was told that on such and such a night, Lysias planned a great attack on his base camp. And that night, Judah left the campfires burning night long, while he and his men crept around and behind the enemy troop. Came the dawn, and Lysias attacked the empty compound. 2 hours before, Judah and his men had attacked the main supply base of all the Greek armies, and what they could not carry away had been cindered, charred, and burned. An army such as Lysias's requires equipment, uniform, provision, arms, and he had to retire north to Damascus to re-equip. But you know, reasonably, all revolutions are hopeless things. Ultimately, power, sheer force of numbers must win through. Negotiate with rebels? Never. Let's escalate the war. And now 60,000 men and 9,000 cavalry and 32 of the ultimate weapons of the day, armed elephants, were sent down into Judea. And Judah and his men fled into the hills. But you know, it is the fortune of rebels that empires always have many problems, many arrows in their bow. There is always competition for power at the center of an empire. There is always a cold war burning hot at the border where one great empire is abrasive against another. And at that very moment, when things looked so bleak, the Emperor Antiochus died in campaign against his Cold War enemy, the Emperor of Parthia. And all the generals and all the proconsuls of the Syrian Greek Empire wheeled with their legions to return to Damascus to compete there for power and control of the empire. And so it was with Lysias. He was nearest to the capital. If he could get there first, he could become the protector of the 6-year-old prince, in fact, emperor of the entire Near East. And so he quickly left Judea with his legions, promising the Judeans in Jerusalem, the Quislings, that he would give an armistice to the land, and in fact that he would rescind the order which had placed the idol in the temple in Jerusalem. But he left with his legions. He left them alone. And it was but a short march for Judah and his men to enter the capital, and with them the country. And the Quislings fled and barricaded themselves in a great fortress, the Agra. And Jerusalem was now Judah's. Victory was his. And he and the people set about, as you well know, cleansing the temple compound, hacking the idol into pieces, purifying the sanctuary, washing it down, and setting it right for a great 8-day festival of rededication. The first Hanukkah, celebrated in that year, 165 before the Common Era. Now, the first Hanukkah was a glorious and joyous event, but it is doubtful the Judah and his men understood the full significance of what they had achieved. They had fought for God and for the ancient tradition. In fact, they preserved monotheism and the biblical tradition for mankind. Had the Judeans, the Quislings, won, had their concept of a syncretistic Judaism, which could accommodate itself to the paganism of the world, become the dominant faith, Judaism would soon have been assimilated into all the other Hellenic mystery cults and disappeared for all intents and purposes from the world. Judah's victory assured the survival of Judaism, assured the birth of Christianity, assured the birth of Islam. The Western world owes its religion to this victory of rebels 2100 and some years ago. This was the moment of Judah's greatest achievement. He was a good man, a brave man who had fought in a good cause. But now, victory, it seemed, had gone to his head. He had fought for his people. He continued to fight for himself, for his family, the Hasmoneans, and for their ambitions. He became another one of the petty despots of the Near East, anxious to impose his control upon his country. He began to intrigue with this general and that in Damascus for authority. The Quislings sensed that there was a chance now to come out of hiding and to compete with the Hasmoneans. They saw that those who had rallied to Judah's band when he fought for God had deserted now that band. And a series of bloody, critically bloody carnage and warfare ravaged Judea for a year, two, and three, until Judah himself fell in a pointless battle before the sword of another Hebrew, also fighting in a pointless cause. Ambition had been kindled by victory in Judah's heart. And like so many of the national leaders of our day, in reemergent Africa, in Southeast Asia, in Latin America, men who had been the tribunes of their people, men who had rallied the rebel for freedom, men who had in their person personified the national hope, Judah, like these men, suddenly victorious, becomes a despot, imposes his will, not the national will, but his will upon the nation. And little by little, his rule becomes not one whit dissimilar to that of the hated overlord. Judah achieved the survival of our faith. But having gained victory, he proved in his life that brilliance as a general, that courage in battle is not enough to qualify a man as a true and significant leader of his people. He explains in his life some of our inherent fear of the general become politician. In war, he is our holy crusader. He wears the mantle of our hopes. Victory won, we discover that his vision is often not ours, but far more narrow and a quite different thing. What then are the hallmarks of the truly significant leader? What courage must be his? I would suggest to you this morning that the mark of the true leader is best seen in the biblical biography of Moses. Like Judah, Moses was physically brave. Like Judah, Moses was willing to set principle above life itself. As a lad, his future was assured. He had only to be conveniently blind to the sadistic cruelty of the taskmaster. And slavery was indigenous, part of the way of life to Egypt. He had only to be blind to the central city and to the slum and the potentiality of riot, and his future was assured. But he took the sword to the taskmaster. Moses was a man of physical courage. Later, during the long desert wanderings, when the people feared an enemy, he rallied their strength. During the entire 40 years of the wandering, Israel was often attacked by enemy, Amalekite, Moabite, Edomite. It was Moses' skill as a general, his courage as a human being, which held the children of Israel together as one people and allowed them to come as one people to the gates of the promised land. But Moses' life indicates that there are levels of courage beyond that of David against Goliath, beyond that of belligerency in the battlefield. That it requires a great deal of courage to restrain yourself, not to talk back to those who jeer you, not to be goaded into anger, not to weigh fist against fist. Gandhi is, after all, the symbol of defiant courage in our generation. And Gandhi never in his life raised his arm to a single man. There is great courage in the young people today, great courage, who are willing to accept the anger of their government and the bitter anger of the public media and of the the mass hold fast to their feeling that the war in which we are engaged is a needless war, and that they will not, in fact, take part in it. What are the hallmarks of courage? The greatest, I believe, is the mark of the man who is truly and wholly committed to the well-being of his people. He has no ambition beyond theirs. He fulfills himself in their success. And God commanded Moses, return to Egypt, free the people. Moses demurred. O Lord, I am thick of tongue. O Lord, I am innocent in the ways of statecraft. Send someone who is more competent. Shalach na Adonai b'yad tishlach. Send someone else, O Lord. Someone who more certainly will be able to succeed than I. Moses was not ambitious to see his name emblazoned in the headlines. Moses was not ambitious to assure his immortality. He did not crave leadership. Duty was thrust on him. Great men accept the mantle of leadership because they must accept that responsibility, and they do not shed the mantle of leadership because no great cause is easily assured. And great men know that they cannot expect the plaudits and the gratitude of their people. Within 2 days after the Exodus had been achieved, children of Israel mumbled and grumbled and rumbled against Moses for having taken them out from the flesh pots of Egypt, where at least the slave master had assured them of a pot and pail of gruel and of mead at the end of every work day. Within a week, there was open talk of rebellion in the camp. Within a month, there was open revolt. Moses had brought them freedom. What more precious gift was there? Yet within 30 days, the people were in open rebellion against him. He had gone up to Sinai to bring down to them a discipline, a teaching, the covenant. And no sooner had he begun to climb the rocky mountain than the people gathered together. They took all of their gold and they made for themselves deliberately in contempt of Moses, a molten idol. Moses worshipped a god who could not be figured. They would worship an idol. And they began to dance around its pedestal in ecstatic abandon. When Moses came down, he found a scene of revel, of vulgarity, of inconstancy, of treachery. Even God had lost his patience. The Bible tells us that as Moses descended, God turned to him and said, I will have no more of the stiff-necked people. I will cut them off from before me. But of you, Moses, and of your family, I will make my people, their future, your future is assured. Here was a chance for a leader to be free of a people who had no gratitude, inconstant and treacherous. And yet Moses would have none of it. He did not sulk in his tent. He did not order the troops against the mass. Rather, the Bible tells us, and Moses returned unto the Lord, and he said, Verily, O Lord, this people have sinned a grievous sin. If thou wilt forgive them, well and good. Ve'im lo, mecheni na misifracha, asher katavta. But if not, blot me out too from the book, from the future, which thou conceivest. Moses had no identity save his identity with the people of Israel. A great leader and his people are one. A parent and child are one. Husband and wife are one. In all of the essential relationships of life, there cannot be any walking away, any turning aside. You cannot say, this people has betrayed me. My husband, my wife has disgraced me. My child has disappointed me. I wash myself of them. Let them pay the piper's price. If any relationship is sacred, it is covenanted, let it be sacred. Yet how many of us turn aside? How many leaders bristle when criticism is made of them? How does a great nation like ours today peremptorily draft those young men who protest our policy? And how is it in families when there is some disappointment and suddenly silence and distance descends upon the home? Let her cease. Friendship is broken. Ordinary men turn aside, cold, angry, bitter. The mark of a great and good man, my friends, the mark of a great and good leader is his constancy, the steadiness of his love. Moses led the children of Israel for 40 years in the desert, 40 long years. There was not a month during that entire history when the people did not complain against Moses. Three times there was open rebellion in the camp. Even when he brought them to the very border of the promised land, they complained against him. Why did you bring us here? Have you no thought for us? These cities are so powerful, the people are so armed. Did you bring us here only to die? Not once did the people of Israel give Moses chanua, a single moment of happy pleasure, a thank you. You know, you and I, mankind generally, love insignificant people. We name our saints from among the anonymous. The well-known and the all-powerful are well-hated. We reserve our bitterest jests and our most cruel judgments for those in authority. So it was with the children of Israel, and so it is with all children of men today. A leader, a parent, a husband, a wife, any mature human being must understand something of the dark psychology of man. He must recognize that there are dark places in every soul, that there is no relationship which is sunlit always, that the stormy winds come and roil the waters, that few will say thank you, that few will be grateful, that often we will expect love and the love will not be spoken. The great man, the good man, the Moses, the mature man, expects ingratitude and loves nevertheless. His love is constant. His devotion to his people is unbreakable. He has one future, one concern, theirs. He is not easily disappointed. He does not sulk in his tent. He does not turn aside from disappointment. He does not withdraw into a cold, bitter anger. He does not become scornful and disgusted, filled with distaste for people. Not at all. He has a vision and a responsibility. And he perseveres. Now on this first day of Hanukkah, it is well to remember the courage and the bravery of a Judah. Our world has need of men, strong young men who will struggle for the right, for freedom, for the good. Judaism is not a quietist faith, but we have need too, far greater need of Moseses among men. Men who will set service above success, responsibility above reward, the community above ambition, of men who will have sufficient balance and inner discipline and confident strength and love to accept the unkind word, the rebuke and the reproof unmerited, the ingratitude and inconstancy and mulishness of men, and persevere in good cause, in God's cause.